This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
7:36 in the morning, you're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Shazana Mokhtar with Philip C. and Wong Xiaoning. In half an hour, we have The Breakfast Grill. Who's in the hot seat this morning, Xiaoning?
A burning company, burning up. Because it's Unique Fire Holdings. They are a fire equipment company. They're slated for listing on the ACE market on the 5th of August, and they aim to raise 21 million ringgit from this IPO. So Keith Kam is going to sit down with Ryan Liu. He's the executive director of this company, to share how hot this business is and how the group plans to utilize the funds raised.
All right. I can just see Philip. He's itching to put in all the puns
that
he can. I won't
extinguish any of my puns.
Now, don't spray any cold water on this. It might do very well.
Stay tuned to this conversation after the 8 a.m. news bulletin. But we're turning our attention now to Sri Lanka. According to Sri Lanka's central bank, the island nation's economy will likely contract by more than 6% this year as political instability and social unrest hamstring key discussions on financial relief with IMF and bilateral creditors. This comes after months of anti-government demonstrations in Colombo, which saw former President Gotabaya Rajapaksa fleeing the country and ultimately resigning over email.
As a result of the economic crisis, Sri Lankans have been struggling with daily power cuts and shortages of basics such as fuel, food and medicines. According to the government, inflation is running at more than 50%. Schools have closed and people have been asked to work from home to help conserve supplies. So how did a country whose economy was the envy of other South Asian countries less than a decade ago get itself to such a position? And what's next for the incoming government in terms of how to fix the economy?
For more on this, we have on the line with us Anushka Wijesingh, economist and co-founder of the Center for a Smart Future, a think tank based in Sri Lanka. Anushka, good morning. Thanks very much for joining us. Can we start with getting a snapshot of the economic situation in Sri Lanka at the moment?
It's really nice to join you. I wish all Malaysian friends a good day. So the situation in Sri Lanka at the moment is quite dire. And the most noticeable factor is, you know, the near complete lack of fuel. You know, some public transport is continuing to run, but myself included, most people don't have fuel in their tanks. There are queues running for kilometers long, snaking around most cities from fuel station to fuel station. People are camped out in their vehicles for 4 to 5 days to try and get fuel. Apart from fuel, there are still regular power cuts in most parts of the country for several hours a day. And also there are shortages of essential imports, including some categories of medicines. So overall, there is a depressed economic mood as people just try and get by, really. In terms of the foreign reserve situation, it's almost down to zero and government has barely enough dollars to import the next fuel shipment.
But how much of the current economic collapse can be traced back to the mismanagement of the Rajapaksa government? Or did the global economic slowdown and COVID have a large part to play in this?
I would argue that almost all of it can be traced back to economic mismanagement of the Rajapaksas and the cabinet, but also the public officials who oversaw key economic institutions like the Treasury, the Central Bank, and so on. There were some crazy tax cuts introduced in December 2019, just after the last presidential elections. And this was an election promise of Gotabaya Rajapaksa. So those tax cuts, nobody really asked for them, but he promised them in the campaign in order to win over businesses. And when those were introduced, Sri Lanka was immediately downgraded by sovereign rating agencies, citing, you know, weak fiscal position. And then it effectively meant we couldn't borrow from international capital markets anymore in order to roll over our maturing sovereign debt. So thereafter, it was simply a cascade of policy errors, one after the other. You know, even at that stage, when things were going south, there could have been attempts to arrest the situation. But we saw very stubborn policymaking, you know, a lot of kind of false bravado and hubris. That continued for 2 years until it all came to a head and this crunch. There is, of course, a component of COVID impacts and also the impacts of the Russia-Ukraine war on wheat prices as well as oil prices. Our tourism earnings completely collapsed for 2 years because of COVID. But many other countries also saw collapses of tourism during COVID, and they haven't got into the kind of trouble Sri Lanka did. I think the groundwork was laid by the poor economic management, and then we were kind of tipped over the edge with everything else that happened.
Now that Rajapaksa has formally resigned, what are the economic priorities of the new government?
Well, the first step is going to be getting a stable government, a government that has some public legitimacy, at least for 6 months to a year until elections can be held. Without this, Sri Lanka cannot get an agreement on an IMF bailout. We can't do the debt restructure. We can't really approach international partners for more funding assistance. So this week will be very interesting. MPs will be meeting in parliament to elect an interim president who will serve out the current presidency term, so 2 years. And they'll also try and form a multi-party unity government. We don't know what that will look like. And even then, we all know in all our countries, different parties have different political ideologies. So that permutation of an interim administration with different parties involved, how are they going to agree on the economic reform program will be a big question. And one thing that some of us have been pushing is there needs to be some consensus about a common minimum program of reform. Because if we don't have that, getting the economic recovery done will be quite challenging.
Anushka, what are the most needed reforms?
The first, I think, has already been started, which is reversing those crazy tax cuts that I mentioned. Some of those taxes have now been restored back to the prior levels, and this will certainly help in improving the fiscal position, help improve government finances. And alongside these reforms that will need to happen is cutting down on government spending. A big part of what got Sri Lanka into this mess in the first place is excessive government spending on unproductive projects, on wasteful projects. Expenditure side reforms, public financial management, tightening, state-owned enterprises that are heavily loss-making, including our national airline, which just a few weeks ago defaulted on a bond as well. So reforming some of those, selling, potentially privatizing part or all of those state-owned enterprise reforms, state-owned enterprises. So those are kind of the reforms that will be needed urgently. But beyond that, perhaps in a government that comes in after elections and a more stable mandate, the reforms would include reforms to trade and investment. Sri Lanka, unlike many countries in ASEAN that have become more open to trade, we have become less open to trade. There have been protectionist trade policies as a way to shore up the economy, but those haven't worked. And that will also have to be a focus of reform.
Can you give us an update status on the IMF meetings with Sri Lankan officials? And, even if the IMF does provide assistance, it won't be immediate. Then in the interim, what are the options available?
Yeah, you're right. It won't be immediate. And in fact, what's happening now, as I understand, is that the staff level discussions, which is essentially the technical work between the IMF staff and the staff at the Ministry of Finance and Central Bank, these have progressed quite a bit, but even the IMF has now said, in light of everything that has happened in the last week, that they need political stability to continue with the discussions and bring it to a close. So after that staff-level agreement is concluded, then it has to go to the IMF's executive board in Washington for approval. That's where there could be a snag, because Sri Lanka has to convince the executive board that we have made good progress on the debt restructure to make our debt more sustainable. So currently, Sri Lanka is not eligible to get any IMF money because our debt is deemed to be unsustainable. So in the meantime, what we're seeing is some assistance from bilateral partners, credit lines coming from the US, some major credit lines coming from India, some food aid coming from countries like China and others. So in the interim, it's a combination of taking these little lines of credit and aid, but also managing with what we have. So currently, monthly, Sri Lanka has about $1 billion of export revenue, maybe about $300 to $400 million from worker remittances, maybe another 150 to 200 on tourism, if that comes back. And alongside that, we'll have an import bill of about 1.3, 1.4 billion. So if the import piece can be kept contained, we could see the trade account being okay for now.
Zooming out of Sri Lanka, is there a possibility of a contagion impact it might have on its South Asian neighbors?
So I wouldn't necessarily call them contagion effects out of Sri Lanka, since Sri Lanka, in the grand scheme of things, is a relatively smaller player in Asia or in the Indian Ocean. But rather, I think there are some signals that Sri Lanka's experience gives to what could happen in other countries facing similar debt distress. We already see this in Laos. In Pakistan also, there's a balance of payments crisis. So I think Sri Lanka's experience signals that a toxic combination of the effects of the pandemic on growth in a country that has unsustainable debt, coupled with bad economic policies, could result in quite similar impacts or quite similar turn of events that we're seeing in Sri Lanka.
Anushka, thanks very much for speaking with us. That was Anushka Wijesingh, economist and co-founder of the Center for a Smart Future in Sri Lanka, talking to us about the economic prospects for this island nation and what needs to be done in order for it to claw its way out of the economic abyss that it finds itself in.
I mean, if you look at the numbers, it's shocking. Inflation 54% in June. The country is also really having really tight fiscal expenditure, $51 billion worth of debt owed to foreign lenders. And whether or not they can restructure that amount of debt is the big question mark.
Yeah, I think it's a chicken and egg, right? Because the political situation now is in dire straits. And with a power vacuum, what does that mean? That there's anybody negotiating on behalf of this country to resolve its economic woes? Because I think on its own, there's very little it can do. It needs some form of assistance, be it from IMF or friendly nations. But with a power vacuum, who's doing that negotiation? That's the question mark, right?
And also the question is whether on the other side, whether they can also corral everybody, because the IMF is discussing a possible $3 billion loan, but that's not going to be enough, right, considering the amount of debt that it's got to shoulder.
I think it's a stopgap measure, but firstly, maybe just to resolve the energy crisis in the country, because there just is no petrol at the moment and a lot of shortage with food and medicines.
I think we'll be following the situation in Sri Lanka for many months to come. Hopefully, we'll have better news in the not-too-distant future. We're taking a break, but we'll come back with a discussion on austerity measures in the Malaysian civil service. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.